Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Austin Peterson here from the Freedom Report. Today is Thursday, May the 29th. I'm here with my co-host, Ian Hewitt. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
All right, Ian, so today we're going to be talking a little bit about non-intervention. Last time we talked about this topic, we had a really good show talking about the potential planned intervention into Nigeria for
and
the...
And not just potential, Obama sent troops to Nigeria.
Well, not troops, he sent a security force.
U.S. military personnel, though.
Right, but they weren't, but they're not active duty troops. These are people who will go in, there's basically law enforcement officials. It's a police action. We're going to talk about foreign policy today because there was a new article that came out in the Washington Post called President Obama's West Point Speech Reads Like a Takedown of Rand Paul. This is by Chris Salica, and I'm just going to break this down piece by piece, and then Ian and I will deconstruct. Read one way, President Obama's big think speech on foreign policy delivered at West Point on Wednesday amounts to a point-by-point takedown of the worldview espoused by Kentucky Senator and all but announced 2016 presidential candidate Rand Paul. Obama never mentions Paul by name, but Paul's views, described as isolationist by his detractors and non-interventionist by his allies, repeatedly function as a rhetorical device against which Obama argues and which he clearly means to reject as part of his broad vision of the post-Iraq, Afghanistan, September 11th world and the United States' role in it. Let's go through a few particularly Paul-y passages from Obama. Obama says, quote, "At least since George Washington served as commander-in-chief, there have been those who warned against foreign entanglements that do not touch directly on our security or economic well-being. Today, according to self-described realists, conflicts in Syria or Ukraine or the Central African Republic are not ours to solve. Not surprisingly, after costly wars and continuing challenges at home, that view is shared by many Americans." Obama, like many Democrats and Republicans who reject the Paul view of the U.S. and the world, uses the idea that this isolationist tendency is nothing new, and since it has failed to catch on fully in the past, argue that it won't catch on this time either. Maybe so, but as Obama acknowledges, the Paul view is one held by a major chunk of the American populace. The chart that they show here in the Washington Post tells
the story.
Far
more Americans think the U.S. should be less involved in policing the world than think it should be more involved.
And it's gotten higher over the years. So in 1995, 34% of the people in the United States believe that we should be less active in the world. But in 2014, today, after Iraq, Afghanistan, and 9/11, 47% now say that we should be less active in the world. Now, let's compare this to 2001, which was the year that 9/11 happened. In 2001, 37% of the people in the world said we needed to be more active, and only 14% said we should be less active.
You know, and the reason that was because Americans wanted to go kick butt and take vengeance
on
the people that had attacked the U.S., but that is not President Obama and his administration's primary motive for intervention. They argue from a standpoint of humanitarian intervention. It's the U.S.'s moral obligation to police these irrelevant conflicts around the world. And that was also the later Bush administration's argument that they made for setting up a democratic state in Iraq and so forth. So Americans have for some time been growing wary of this, I think, especially as America has so many of its own economic problems to resolve at home. And I don't like this headline because takedown implies it was effective. I think it was an attempted criticism of Rand Paul. His use of the term realist, I think, was more or less a direct reference to Rand Paul. Rand Paul has been popularizing that term to reference non-interventionism. And I think that this speech was a step in the right direction, really, because while Obama has been very interventionist in his policies, he typically has not been so overtly neocon-esque and we can fix the whole world in his rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Now that he's doing this, I think the debate will become clearer and more honest, and society in general can recognize that pro-war interventionism is a thing of the left.
Now, we have to be honest with ourselves, Ian, when we take a look at the Republican Party and we look at the Democratic Party especially, the history of these two political parties has not been historically a non-interventionist party. Neither of these parties have ever technically really been non-interventionist parties. If you remember, the election of Dwight Eisenhower was seen as a rejection of the isolationists at the time. Now, it didn't used to be known as a slur to call someone an isolationist. That was simply known as your position when it came to isolationism was conflated with non-interventionism historically. Now, in the modern times, libertarians have attempted to sort of separate the word isolationism from non-interventionism, and indeed even tried to redefine the term isolationism by trying to equate it with neoconservatives who try to paint us as who cause us to be more isolated in the world with their interventionist policies.
Right, that's a good strategy of Rand Paul.
It is a good strategy by all of us.
President Obama referenced George Washington's view and rejected it because what he's really saying is, I acknowledge that the conservative view is the traditional American position, and mm-hmm. I reject it.
Right.
So, I mean, we can be confident that we're in the camp of George Washington. Mm-hmm. Where do you stand?
No, I'm going to...
Even Obama...
Hold on. Now, I want to play devil's advocate with you on that, Ian, mm-hmm. because you say that Washington's view has been the traditional American position. It's been the traditionally stated American position, but it's never been the traditionally held American position. America has... We've never been a non-interventionist country. So when has the American government ever not intervened somewhere around the world?
You're right to point out that both parties have historically been interventionist, but which party has been more interventionist historically? The progressives were strongly in favor of the Spanish-American War, which was seen as a clash against the backwards conservative forces of Spain. Mm-hmm. Democrats, JFK first sent troops to Vietnam. LBJ escalated the war in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Truman, a Democrat, started the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And even if you look at just the 2000 elections, look at the presidential debates about foreign policy. Very clearly, Al Gore was the one who wanted a more active interventionist military presence on the world stage. And George Bush said he wanted a more humble foreign policy and to not nation build around the world.
Yes, but again, just like George Washington, George W. Bush says one thing and does another. So I think that the problem is that so often we like to talk about the historical legacy of non-interventionism in the United States just because of the words of politicians, but never because of their actions. So
right.
I mean, but here's
his
the
actions
thing.
After 9/11, and I think the post 9/11 era has been a historical fluke. I think mm-hmm. our generation, so to speak, has a really skewed view of where interventionism typically is on the political spectrum mm-hmm. because of 9/11. Mm-hmm. Now, with speeches like President Obama's, I think we're more and more going to acknowledge that interventionism is a thing of the left.
Mm-hmm. I would hope so. Now, here's the thing. Let's move on. I want to take on the next big attack, potential attack from Obama against Rand Paul. American influence is always stronger when we lead by example. We cannot exempt ourselves from the rules that apply to everyone else. It's a lot harder to call on China to resolve its maritime disputes under the Law of the Sea Convention when the United States Senate has refused to ratify it. Despite the repeated insistence of our top military leaders that the treaty advances our national security. That's not leadership, that's retreat. That's not strength, that's weakness. And then the analysis from the Washington Post is, the direct shot at the Senate, and though not named Senate Republicans, is as close as Obama got in the speech to calling out the Paulist worldview by name. The Law of the Sea Convention died in the Senate in the summer of 2012 when Democrats failed to rally the two-thirds support necessary to end debate and bring it to a vote. Paul was one of the 34 Republican senators officially on record in opposition. Also, in case you didn't get what Obama thought of the views of the likes of Paul, the use of the words retreat and weakness should clear that up nicely. So basically, Obama is saying that because Senate Republicans chose not to give the United Nations control of the oceans, that's a sign of weakness and a sign of retreat. I would actually clear characterize that as the opposite. What do you think, Ian?
Yeah, I think if you stack stones into a wall, you have strength. If you scatter them uselessly on the ground, you have weakness.
What is that metaphor?
That's what interventionism does. When you overextend your power and you try to babysit the entire planet at your expense, I think that's a weak foreign policy. Overextended empires have historically inevitably collapsed. Strong, enduring nations have consolidated their power. So there is no historical reason for President Obama to equate non-intervention with weakness. I think he's right that we should lead by example, and that's the way to have the best influence on the world. But I think President Obama and libertarians certainly disagree as to how to go about doing that.
Now, I try and avoid too much philosophical posturing here in the podcast because I try and stick to the news, but I do want to just ask you a question, Ian, because it's something that I struggle with. You know, as a libertarian, my goal is always to try and reduce the role of government in our lives. But when I look at the Roman Republic, for example, when you say, you know, you're looking at overextended empires, it seems that it's the natural course of government to grow and for liberty to shrink. And so it almost seems inevitable that countries such as ourselves, our republics, would turn from republics into an empire, such as the Roman Empire did. I mean, the long history of the world shows that governments only get bigger. They never voluntarily limit themselves in size. They're only restrained through means such as our own revolution, our violent revolution, in order to construct a more limited government. So I wonder, and this is again, this is just
Philosophy. I'm glad you brought up Rome, actually, because before Rome was an empire, it was a republic for 400 years, I believe, longer than the United States has existed. And it was a republic after having been a kingdom. The Romans overthrew their king and drove the king out and made their city-state into a republic for hundreds of years. So I think that in some cases, we have certainly seen sustained decentralized societies. Rome was not one, but there are better examples than Rome. But for a long period of time, Roger Long has pointed out that Iceland, for example, was a very decentralized society that libertarians would admire from a legal standpoint, also for longer than the United States has existed. So now let me concede a point. Certainly, I think it is inevitable that people will try to consolidate overarching power, no doubt. I also think it's inevitable that humans will commit acts of violence. I think humans have an innate tendency to commit acts of violence, but I don't think it logically follows that we should submit to acts of violence. I think by recognizing that, we are best equipped to safeguard ourselves against violence. Recognizing that, you know, disease in the human body is inevitable.
Right.
That enables us to most effectively combat disease. It doesn't mean we should surrender to disease because it'll happen anyway.
Right, but the question is whether the strategy for liberty should be one of libertarians to attempting to prolong what may be the inevitable, or whether or not we should be attempting to push it off the cliff. Let's move on. Remember that because of America's efforts through diplomacy and foreign assistance, as well as the sacrifices of our military, more people live under elected governments today than any time in human history. This is Obama speaking. He says, in Egypt, we acknowledge that our relationship is anchored in security interests, from the peace treaty with Israel to shared efforts against violent extremism. So we have not cut off cooperation with a new government. But we can and will persistently press for the reforms that the Egyptian people have demanded. And this is the Washington Post responding. Rand Paul conducted a high-profile attempt to cut the $1.5 billion in U.S. aid to Egypt and redirect it to American infrastructure improvements last summer. While Paul's amendment, he was trying to get it on a transportation bill, was tabled, he did get the votes of 12 other senators, including Mike Lee and Ted Cruz. He says, all I can see is the billions of American tax dollars that he chooses to send overseas, Paul said of President Obama. The president sends billions of dollars to Egypt in the form of advanced fighter planes and tanks while Detroit crumbles. In 1 hour of need of our country, why are you sending money to people that hate us? Paul has been an outspoken on USA to Israel, calling it welfare to a wealthy nation in 2011. Is he right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my response to his point about democratic states would be, so what, I guess? You know, if you live in a democratic state that conducts regular human sacrifice, is that preferable to a non-democratic state that doesn't? Like, why does democracy have this just inherent overriding value.
Well, it doesn't. That's such a cop out because people just, like you and I understand that, Ian. But
it's common
most
sense.
Most people
though,
think
that
democracy is good.
If you have, you know, a majority by one in a group that makes some horrendously immoral decision, that doesn't make the decision moral. Like, everyone recognizes that. So apply that to the political level as well.
Yeah, I know, but the problem is that for you and I, like, we are the Illuminati of the world, you know. You and I, we understand this concept, but most people, when they think of democracy, they think, oh, well, it's overall, it's better to have a democracy as a form of governance than a monarchy, you know. But libertarians, we're like, in our dirty secret circles, we talk about the fact that, you know, like, well, maybe a benevolent monarchy would be much better than a tyrannical social democracy, and we can have that discussion, but man, don't take that to the American public school child, because they've been trained something else.
Well, any one of those people, if you then ask them, well, if, you know, two or three people gang up on you, does that make it moral? Mm-hmm. Is that more moral than if one person attacked you? People can very easily be made to see, I think, that there is no sound moral argument here.
Right. And the argument here is the same argument that we've been fighting since the end of World War II, is just how much foreign aid do we need to give to a country in order to make sure that the instability of their country doesn't contribute to the instability of our country. A perfect example of that might be, let's take North Korea and South Korea, right? So South Korea sort of doesn't want North Korea to collapse because of the humanitarian crisis that would be involved. You know, the United States doesn't want the government of Mexico to collapse because of the humanitarian crisis involved. So it becomes a question of just, you know, balancing not only the interest, the taxing interests of the people, where you're trying not to tax people to subsidize foreign countries, like a wealthy nation such as Israel, but let's look at a non-wealthy nation such as Mexico. I mean, would it be worth it to us to subsidize Mexico if it meant that their government would not collapse and we would have to deal with perhaps a larger humanitarian crisis? Would the burden on the citizens of the United States be larger, and I'm playing devil's advocate here,
right,
be larger dealing with a humanitarian crisis than it would be to prop up the government of Mexico?
Well, let's assume that it is morally preferable for every nation in the world to have a democratic government. If we concede that point, mm-hmm. would it be okay if we made every country in the world democratic by impoverishing and severely weakening our own nation?
Mm-hmm.
Does that logically follow? To what extent are we willing to sacrifice the well-being of Americans, mm-hmm. whose you know, job it is... the government's job is to protect Americans, mm-hmm. and not
sure.
to safeguard the entire planet. Most people recognize
right.
that to some extent. To what extent is that true?
So, exactly. And again, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. You know, I don't hold these views, but I'm trying to ask this question because I think it does pose a real problem. If propping up the democratic government of Mexico would stem a humanitarian crisis that would result in a higher cost on American citizens, you know, again, refugees fleeing across the border, violence, and things like that. How do you balance those interests? Because the question is that if you have to deal with, should the Americans have to deal with the humanitarian crisis, or should they have to deal with the crisis of democracy? And that's really, I think, a lot of times that's the ultimate moral question that government will try to impose to us.
Right,
they'll say,
we can
know,
weigh American interests. I think
right.
that's not really being done at all currently. I mm-hmm. don't think anyone thinks that, you know, kidnappings in Nigeria have some tangible effect on American
but
interests.
But Netanyahu would argue that propping up, keeping Israel subsidized in such a way gives the United States a tremendous benefit. And he makes very good points about maintaining the only stable democratic country in the Middle East that is not hostile to the United States. There are a lot of good, strong, sound moral arguments there. I don't see it fit that it necessarily means we should be subsidizing him.
I don't know that Israel benefits much from being dependent on the United States.
I'll agree, but you and I, we're in the minority with that viewpoint. The rest of the United States, I would say probably for the majority of the United States of people, disagree with us. And so we have to find better ways to make these arguments, because I think we've been using these arguments for so long, they haven't been working for us.
Well, I should point out, people in the United States want to cut foreign aid more than they want to cut any other area of spending.
Mm-hmm.
Even taxpayer funding for the arts.
Mm-hmm.
Less people want to cut that than want to cut foreign aid. So I think this is actually a strong talking point for libertarians.
Mm-hmm.
What we need to do is cause people to understand that a lot of what the U.S. does in the world militarily is effectively foreign aid. It mm-hmm. is done at the expense of Americans and American troops, and does nothing to benefit people in the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's move on to the last point here by President Obama. Mr. Obama says, "Global leadership requires us to see the world as it is, with all its danger and uncertainty. But American leadership also requires us to see the world as it should be, a place where the aspirations of individual human beings matter, where hopes and not just fears govern, where truths written into our founding documents can steer the currents of history in the direction of justice. And they close by saying, this reads as a more or less direct rebuke to Paul's insistence on the need for a more realistic foreign policy. I really am a believer that the foreign policy must be viewed by events as they present themselves, not as we wish them to be, Paul said in his speech. Obama makes the case that realism isn't enough, that part of the U.S.'s role in the world is to imagine how things could be and then undertake a set of policy prescriptions to make that image come to life. What's your take on that?
Well, I would say, one, to quote Russell Kirk, to seek for utopia is to end in disaster. People seem to be presuming that it's possible to end all kidnappings in the world. Mm-hmm. And since that is not true, you're effectively agreeing to stop all kidnappings everywhere for all time. That requires an indefinite, endless bloating of government. Mm-hmm. I would also point out that I really don't think that having a single unipolar source of power in the world is a desirable goal. I don't think it'd be beneficial for the United States. I think that we benefit from the existence of other nations that are in some ways different from us. And I also think by concentrating power over the whole planet into, you know, into one pole, I think that's really the goal here, we would be placing an enormous risk on, you know, everyone, mm-hmm. essentially. It would be enormously easy for that power to be abused and be abused everywhere.
Have you ever watched the films or the television show Star Trek?
I'm not too familiar with Star Trek.
Okay, no. Star Trek, it's sort of like, I wouldn't say utopian future, but basically what has happened is that all of the governments of the world have put together the Federation. They've come together into the Federation, and the Federation basically represents planet Earth and all, you know, human life on the planet there. And so the vision of that is a government that leads the world in a sort of a utopian manner, but the question is here, Ian, because here's the thing, if we are talking about the future here, you know, and I like to think of the future not just the future next 200, 300 years, I like to think about the next 1,000 years, then the future means that potentially we will have to deal with life not only on our own planet, but life on other planets. And I'm not talking about aliens, I'm talking about, you know, humans possibly expanding into space. And Neil deGrasse Tyson is famous for saying that when it comes to space travel, government will have to lead the way. And so I think that if we're going to deal with, here's the thing, he talks about American leadership requires us to see the world as it should be. Should the American government project itself into space? I mean, should that mean that all governments of the world should coalesce into the United States? Because here's what I want to know is, where does this end? You know, like, where does this idea of American leadership end? Does it mean that if one day, let's say that one day we were attacked by aliens, would every single government of the world all team up together to fight this threat? Most likely.
Well, it'd clearly be in our interest to collaborate. That wouldn't lead to necessarily having one singular government.
I would disagree, but I would like to bet that I would contend that if we were attacked by aliens, that all the governments of the world would coalesce and fight the alien menace. And then if we were to survive that battle, a one world government would emerge.
Well, that would entail every government in the world giving up its own power over its own territory. That would not be in their self-interest. So I think what you'd be more likely to see would be people creating a sort of federation whereby everyone collaborates on defense, but people maintain their regional sovereignty.
It would be a worldwide NATO, in a sense. I mean, for the most part, I mean, you wouldn't really be NATO. It would be the Federation, in a sense, because
there you go.
If you think about it, the United States would probably be the most likely the group to lead it, just like we did in World War II. Eisenhower took control of he was the supreme commander of all of the Allied forces. And you would probably see something like that where America would lead. And Obama is talking about this from an idea of seeing the world as it should be. I mean, how much do we see ourselves as shaping the world? I think that there is probably no end to the aspirations of these big government types. And they probably see themselves as the builders, or the architects of a new civilization. And when they talk about a one world government, when you look at a one world government from the science fiction point of view, you know, you can see Star Trek, and it seems to be a very beautiful utopian vision of the future. But you know, again,
it's fiction.
It is fiction, Ian, but if you understand the conflicts of the past, it's not unfeasible to think that if we had a conflict in the future where we were facing a threat to humanity, that everybody wouldn't coalesce together. It wouldn't be the case for big government, for world government. I'm not saying we need it, but what I'm saying is that in a short time period, it could be totally feasible that we would need it. And if we did need it for that short time to fight that government, to fight an extraplanetary force, would that government then go away on its own? Most likely not.
It would propel people towards some sort of alliance, but people do, thankfully, have some desire to maintain their own internal affairs. Mm-hmm. And to live and exist in community. Mm-hmm. And so a single unitary power would thankfully not be sustainable, because that would be nightmarish. It would be uniform. I think that would be a terrible world to live in.
But here's the question. I mean, wouldn't you, not that I want to see these ideas brought about in the world by force, but there are certain American values that we have, certain Western values that we have that we think ought to be shared all over the world, don't you? Aren't there, you know, liberalism for females, privilege for the right to go to school and to, you know, to have choice for females? There's all sorts of Western values that we think ought to be shared all around the world. How can we deny, and again, playing devil's advocate here, because mm-hmm. there's no liberal on the podcast, playing devil's advocate here, you know, I guess I share the yearning that some of these liberal internationals have for other countries of the world to adopt some of our policies. I know many libertarians don't, because some of the libertarians are true isolationists and they don't give a damn what happens overseas.
Right, well, this is a good point. I should clarify, I'm clearly not a moral relativist. Mm-hmm. I do think that there is one absolute truth. Mm-hmm. But the reason I value diversity of thought, diversity of culture, is because these things enable us to find the absolute truth. Mm-hmm. If you had one decider that decided for everyone, mm-hmm. it's very probable they would impose the wrong decision everywhere. Mm-hmm. The existence of competing political entities enables one of them to make the right decision. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to safeguard the truth, mm-hmm. is through decentralization.
Right. But the thing is that what if in a scenario where a minority holds the ultimate truth and the majority is against the ultimate truth, but the minority has the power to project itself towards the majority and to do so by force, should it be done? If the truth is found, if the objective truth is found, should the minority attempt to project it upon the minority? That's the opposite of what's happening now.
Well, if you gave me like the opportunity to press a button and create some sort of global Christian hegemony, where if a few, you know, great Christians that I admired could rule the planet,
right,
or something, I would absolutely not do that, because I recognize that since humans are fallen, inevitably people with terrible ideas would get into that position of power and abuse it to impose the wrong decision everywhere.
That's the realist viewpoint. Thanks a lot for sharing that for us, Ian. That's really fantastic. Will, a great conversation. What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Do you think the United States is the beacon for freedom all around the world? Should we be a global power for good? Or should the United States mind its own business and take care of its own people? We want to hear what you guys think. Go to thelibertarianrepublic.com and send us a tip. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Leave us a good review. Have you been listening to the podcast? Do you like it? Go to iTunes, give us 5 stars, and leave us a positive review, because that really helps us get the message out. And as always, you can go to thelibertarianrepublic.com every single day. Your home for economic freedom and personal liberty at thelibertarianrepublic.com.